Okay. Well, first of all, great of you all to skip lunch for just hearing me talk. I'm missing lunch as well. This is my lunch. And, well, I hope to get through the day. I've heard the session is overbooked, but if any of your friends or colleagues are trying to get in and didn't get were able to get in, I'm doing a repeat of the session tomorrow. Actually, I'll do the shorter version of the presentation today because the original presentation I did at Tech at US, it has 75 minutes of material in it, and now I only have 45 minutes, so either I have to talk really fast or I have to skip some of the material, which I probably will do. For those of you expecting a talk about a particular framework, this is not about a particular framework. I will show you examples from a lot of frameworks. And the issue about this talk is that if you ask people in projects about what is your software architecture, what does it look like? There's a lot of people in a lot of projects that will tell you, well, we have in our software architecture, we have Silverlight or WCF RIA services, and we have Entity Framework or in Hibernate or whatever. And that's not a software architecture. That is a list of frameworks. A list of frameworks will never be a software architecture. And the issue is with frameworks is that, well, there's actually a lot of issues with frameworks, and that's the first part of the talk. I will try to explain to you what will happen to your frameworks you're using. Not that I will show what the features will be in the next version, but I will give you a sense of what the trouble can be if you start using frameworks. First of all, I have to stress that using frameworks is great. Actually, if you would ask me what is the best thing in software development, it is developing a framework. I like that a lot. I've been doing that for about 25 years now, and that's one of my, I would say, one of my hobbies, to build frameworks, and I suppose a lot of you people are doing the same. Well, let me tell you, if you start using frameworks, either from open source or from Microsoft or from some other vendor, there's always some work that needs to be done, and you can always write a little framework of yourself that just sits on top of the frameworks you're using just to create some layer of independence. And that's a bit about the topic I will talk about. So, who am I? Well, my name is Sander Hogendoorn, which spells okay in German and in Dutch, but in English and French it's horrible. When I walk into a hotel, I always have to spell my name. I work for Capgemini, which is a global, very large consultancy firm. I think we employ about 100,000 people worldwide or something. I don't know them all, but I know quite a few of them, by the way. And I have this peculiar function title, which is called Principal Technology Officer. And in Dutch, there's an expression. I try to translate that in English. It says, Chief of Empty Boxes. That means I do a lot of stuff, but I don't have any mandate, so I'm not going to push anything to anybody. I just do things I like to do, and that is innovate in software development. And that contains processes and frameworks and testing and whatever comes to mind. So the important part about this slide is actually this one. This is my Twitter account. You can read a lot of my stuff I do here at Twitter. Also, if you want to respond to the session, don't hesitate sending me a tweet out. And in any case, don't forget to fill out your evaluation forms for the session. So, as I said, there's a repeat tomorrow. Actually, it's a repeat of the session I did yesterday that also had a full room. I don't know why exactly, but I was asked to do this talk three times. Probably all of the rooms were booked full. And I will be doing a different breakout session on Friday, and that has a totally different topic. It goes on about how to implement requirements actually in web applications and how to unit test your requirements and stuff like that, which is also a very interesting story I can tell you. So what are we going to do? Well, I'm going to start with some story, a small story about frameworks. What can go wrong with it? What are the issues about it? How do you learn new frameworks? How do you try to implement them? And then slowly move on to a bit about software architecture. And that software architecture actually comprises a lot more than just having a list of frameworks. And I'll show you some of the patterns that you might use to create this very little or tiny or thin layer of independence to be able to manipulate your frameworks that you use a bit more. One of the feedbacks I got from yesterday is that, hey, there's a lot more patterns than just these three. Yes, there are. There are so many patterns that I would need about 2 days to use them to explain them all to you, the ones you can use. But these three in particular, we use it a lot in our own set of frameworks. So I'll be showing a lot of examples from that. And these are patterns that usually do not show up that often if you talk about patterns and frameworks and stuff like that. So they might be really of interest to you. So that's the story. Okay, let's start off with frameworks. You know, in software development, as we will be unable to solve all problems in development and will not be able to deliver all software that the world actually needs, productivity is a big thing. And frameworks can help you get to a higher productivity, which is good. But then there's Hofstadter's law that says it always takes longer than you expect, even when you take into account Hofstadter's law. And that's the same thing with software development. It always takes longer than you expect at first hand. Because if you start using frameworks in your applications, you might think, hey, this will save me some time. But there's a lot of stuff you need to do before you can start with developing frameworks. So, with using frameworks. So I did a little research a while ago when I first started doing this talk and asked people about their motivation, about why are you using frameworks anyway? And most people think they will develop software faster. And that might be the case. But before you can do that, actually, you know, frameworks never just offer the things you need. Either they lack features or they have features in abundance, which means you will learn a lot of features from a framework that you actually do not need for your projects. And that's a bit too much. So there's some steps to take. What are the steps to take if you start implementing frameworks? Well, first of all, you have to pick a number of frameworks. But I will show you in the second half of the talk, the way you could pick your frameworks is different than just go to a website and say, hey, this looks like a nice website, or this has been promoted at TechEd by some dude who created the framework, so I'm going to use that one, either if that's Entity Framework 4 or in Hibernate or whatever framework you might see, like ASP.NET MVC 3 or 2 or 2.5 or whatever. So these are all great frameworks, but there's reasons to choose for particular frameworks. And then there's a whole bunch of other things that I will briefly go through that you need to do. So first of all, you will need to pick your frameworks. And the topic with frameworks is that there's so many different frameworks. Actually, there's so many different types of frameworks. There's frameworks that go through all of it, like the Spring framework. It does a lot of things for you. It has an MVC implementation in it. It has persistence in there, well, if you use an Hibernate with it. There's dependency injection in there. There's logging in there. And the same goes for things like Enterprise Library, for instance. There's a whole lot of blocks in Enterprise Library that you might use in your projects. And you have to figure out how to use them together. And then there's frameworks that say, well, I'm going to address a particular layer in my application or in my application architecture. Like Silverlight is such a framework. Or WPF is such a framework that goes onto your user interface. And there's frameworks that deal with persistence in your data layer, like in Hibernate or Entity Framework. And there's a lot of stuff in between there too. So this is frameworks that address a particular layer. And there's much, much more frameworks than these that I put on the slide. And then there's also frameworks that sort of sit on the side of your application. Like they deliver services that help you implement stuff better. Like there's logging frameworks, or there's dependency injection frameworks like Unity or Object Builder or Structure Map, or in the Spring framework and in the Castle project, there's also some dependency injection. And you can have frameworks for particular, let's say, aspects of your applications that you're building. So there's a lot of things to pick from. So if you look at Codeplex, for instance, this is not even a recent screen grab. I think I did this in June something for TechEd US. And, you know, there's around 10,000 projects on Codeplex. How do you choose from that? It's impossible to do that because there's much too much. And I had a whole bunch of slides with other examples. I'll just skip those. They're not in there anymore. But say you've picked on a framework and you found out why you want to use the framework. So the next step will be convincing the management that you actually need to use this framework. And that's hard. And that's mostly because they're stronger than you, but they ask different questions. They ask questions like, how many percent more productive will you be using this framework? And questions like that are very hard to answer. What does it cost to implement it? How many days of training do I need for my developers, et cetera, et cetera? So they have totally different motivation in getting to a framework than you might have as a developer. It might be fun to implement this framework, or it saves a whole lot of stuff I need to do elsewise manually, like creating an object relational mapping, for instance. That's a lot of work. It's fun to do, by the way, but it's a lot of work. And once you've done that, once you actually convince the management, hey, this is the way to go, then the next step will be understanding the framework. And understanding the framework is difficult because different developers have different views on what it does and on what features the framework needs. So you might actually have different thoughts from the other developers in your project. And once you've done it, well, it's okay to convince your developer, to understand what it is. And the next thing is, getting the other developers convinced about it too. And this is a fun slide. You know, I use this slide a lot. And when I do talks at Java conferences, I sometimes do that. Okay, sorry about that, but I sometimes do that. Then I switch the logos. Okay, so you convince the other developers that that's the easiest part. And the next thing is train everybody. Make sure everybody understands how you use the framework, what features you're using, how to implement it, describe some guidelines for doing that, etc., etc., and train the people. And then you think, okay, we're there. We can build now. We can now build our software, our test run. Great, we're there. And then, it's only then that the real trouble comes in. And the real trouble sits in what frameworks do and how frameworks are developed, actually. And there's a lot of stuff that might go wrong with using a framework and applying it. I'll show you some anti-patterns. What if the framework has a lot of features, but it does just not have the feature you need? And the first thing you will do is check what's the feature list for the next version of your framework, right? Or it might also be the case that, hey, I'm going to try another framework. Can you do that in the middle of a project? Well, sometimes you can, and sometimes it's not really wise to do that. I've seen that in projects that productivity drops to zero for about 3 iterations. That's bad. But it can happen, and it might be necessary. But then the next thing happened. What if we find actually a framework that does the work better? For instance, you have an OR mapper like Entity Framework and Hibernate or a lot of other frameworks that do that, and it doesn't perform really well. I've seen some of these frameworks that actually do not perform. I'm not going to mention names now, but I've seen some of these frameworks that could have slightly better performance. Then you might say, I'm going to change, for instance, from Entity Framework to an Hibernate or the other way around, whatever you like. Or perhaps your company has a strategy that we will use, I don't know, Microsoft projects, unless there's a better one. So you might want to change. And that's okay, but what if the framework contains bugs? Well, that's okay if you have the source code, you would say, because we're all developers. So if I have the source code, I can change the framework. Well, to tell you the truth, that's not the path you should go to. Because if you do that, and the next version of the framework comes along, you will be in deep trouble. In most cases, by the way, frameworks tend to get better over the years. They tend to get more features, and the features better implemented or more neatly implemented. And it is not very unlikely that the features that you miss in this version will be in the next version. So you will need to be able to move to the next version of the framework if you want to solve the bugs. And another thing that might happen in an open source community for the bigger part, the framework might be discontinued for some reason. Maybe the developer got ill. Maybe he moved from .NET to JavaSpace or whatever, or the other way around. That seems to be happening a lot more these days. And at Java conference, I do not tell the same, by the way, but I tell them Java is still a nice language, which it is, by the way. But this will get you into trouble, too. And then the last part is, okay, there's a new version of the framework, but it's implemented totally different. That happens. It actually happens with all sorts of frameworks. Open source frameworks, but also with Microsoft frameworks. And I'll show you some examples of it. In the end, this is what kills you. Suppose you're using a bunch of frameworks, and they're the gray classes in here, and the yellow classes and the orange classes are your actual application. If you've built your architecture like this, you will be in trouble, definitely. Why? Well, simply because there are so many dependencies between your actual application and the frameworks you're using. If something happens to your frameworks, if you want to move to a newer version, if you want to add features to it, or whatever you're doing, this will definitely get you into trouble. If you have 250 references to some framework, let's say you're doing, who of you is doing dependency injection in their applications? That's not a lot. I would expect much more. So if you create an object, you will need a reference to the DI engine you're using. So if you create objects all over the place, then it's likely that you will have code to your referencing to your DI engine all over the place. What if you want to change to another DI engine? For instance, we started using Object Builder a few years ago, and Microsoft moved to a new implementation in Patterns and Practices. They now got the Unity block, which is much better. How do you change that if you have over 250 references to that? You're going to have to test all your software over again, and that's a lot of work, I can tell you. So dependencies will kill you every time. So, you know, as a framework developer, it's very hard to understand what's happening in actual projects. If you're building a framework and it has a set of features, you'll never know whether that's the features people will actually need. So here's the framework developer, and we're doing the best we can, of course, as framework developers. We're trying to solve the puzzles as best as possible, but we do not know all of the projects that are out there. So it's very hard to understand every requirement that any project might have. So there's always things missing. There's always things that are implemented differently than you might expect or than you want it to be. And that's, okay, as a framework developer, sorry about that. It happens. There's nothing you can do about that. But in the end, it's the application developer that gets bugged for it. Because if the frameworks you're using do not do what they need, you might have to write a lot of code in there to make it perform the way you want it to. So that's one thing. I'll give you an example. This one, for instance, this is an entity data model, and it's used by the entity framework, or you can generate it if you're using entity framework, and out comes this code. Have you seen this code? Anybody of you is using entity framework? Who is? That's also not a lot. You're building your own persistence layers, I guess? Who of you is using Anhibernate? The rest of you, you don't have any data? Or what do you do? You build embedded software, I guess? So this particular thing is called an entity object, which is sort of the base class, and it's called a layer supertype, as I will explain later. It's the base class for all the entities generated by Entity Framework. And if you do this, there's a lot of people who implement a domain layer, and you actually should implement a domain layer. You should always do that. And they implement it using these entity objects, which means these entity objects will end up as your domain objects. And you can do that, but that means you will get a very tight dependency on Entity Framework. And this is just an example. It's not to bash on Entity Framework. And with Entity Framework in this entity object, you get a lot of code in there. There's so much code in there. If you look at the generated classes, they look a bit big. And I want my domain objects to be small. So I'm not going to use my entity object as the root for my domain objects. That's something you shouldn't do, because you're too much depending on what entity framework does. And if there's a new version coming out, they might change the implementation. You'll never know. They might not, but they might do that. So you get all this code for free, which is in the entity framework classes. And there's a lot of code in there. And there's a lot of code in there that you might actually do not want to use, or you want to implement it differently. If you do not want to implement the on-property changing event or whatever, you might want to do that differently. Have a different mechanism for that. And if you use entity objects as your base class, you will not be able to do that. So you have to get a way around that. And then there's the next problem, and that is, we as developers, we love frameworks. How do you know that? Well, because if there's a new beta coming out from any of the frameworks that you might want to use, people start using that in projects. From the very first beta. I've been doing that for years, and it gets me into trouble every time. I'll show you an example. This is the example. It comes from the very first beta of ASP.NET MVC. And we did a project in Belgium that used this framework heavily. And this is the basic implementation for an action. And it says, well, there's a void, and it has something coming in. This is actually done by naming convention in the framework. And in the end, you say render view, blah, 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 whatever. So it's not about what this code does. It's about the changes you get. Well, next came the beta 2, and the release candidate, and the final version of the version 1 of ASP.NET MVC, and the code changed. You know, if you build a lot of these actions, and this project actually had hundreds of them, and the code changes from that to this, this is another one of those actions, but with a different version. This is from the final version 1, and it has an action result defined as the return type instead of a void, which meant we had to go through all of these actions that we already implemented and change them. And we had to retest the whole application again. And you know, there were some bugs coming from that. So if you start using betas, it's always fun to discover new stuff. But maybe using betas is a bit too soon, because frameworks actually change, especially from coming from betas. And there's another interesting part about frameworks. You can see this from my research. I asked people, what are the frameworks you use most often? And they said, well, actually, there's two of them really standing out. It's Log4Net, which is a logging framework, and it's Anhibernate, which is a persistency framework. And you might wonder why these two percentages are so high, and why this percentage is even higher than that one. There's a reason for that. And the reason is this. This is code actually coming from Anhibernate. It's an open source project, so you can look at the code, you can browse through it. in this particular piece of code, it says, I'm creating a static read-only iLog, which is an interface to log, log events or whatever you log. And it uses a log manager.getLogger. This particular line of code and this particular class do not reside in an Hibernate. These come from log4net directly, which means there's a direct dependence from an Hibernate to log4net. So what if you're in a company that says, hey, we're using the enterprise library as well? I was at a customer last week that actually had that problem. They were using two different logging frameworks in the application. Why? Well, one of them was the enterprise library logging block, which they use for a lot of projects. And the next one was log4net, because they're using an Hibernate. That will not deliver the most beautiful code that you will see, because you have to log things twice or whatever you do. You have to make a choice when to log what, or make sure the implementations that you actually are using to log actually are the same and log to the same event logger or whatever you do. So it'll get you into trouble anyway. So these dependencies, and it's a quite big dependency, because I checked, and last time I checked, there were about 143 references in the Hibernate code to the log manager. That's quite a lot to remove. But they should have designed it actually a bit differently, I would say. And I'll show you in a moment how you can do that. And the next thing is, okay, frameworks are good, but they will have new versions. And these new versions might be implemented a bit differently from what you might expect. So as it comes with versions, this is the original movie. This is a great movie. They won an Oscar for it, you see. Well, actually, it was the title song, I guess, but... well, there's new versions coming along, and there's a lot of versions. And there's a difference between this picture and the actual frameworks that you might use. Frameworks tend to get better. So they actually do. And but they change the implementation. This one comes from the Microsoft website, and it says, okay, this is actually when they start doing WF4. They said, well, let's see. As we are designing WF4, we wanted to address the feedback and the pain points that we have gathered over the past few years from the community, which is good, by the way. It's good that they listen to the community, and they do that a lot at Microsoft. And they said, well, it didn't all have all these improvements, so we're now making these improvements. Great. That's great. And then they said, as we expanded WF, it became clear that the WF3 architecture just wasn't created with the above in mind. Is anybody of you using WF3? Has anybody of you have moved from 3 to 4? Yeah. That's a pain in the ass, wasn't it? Yeah. We've done that too at a project, a very large project for a very large international bank. And actually what they did is they based all their activities. They created a class that inherited from the code activity and built all their stuff in that. And then the next statement came along. And they said, if you are currently writing workflow code, please do not use the code activity anymore. If you're doing a very large project with hundreds of thousands of lines of code inheriting from this, you will be in trouble. And they actually got into a lot of trouble. I think the project delivered 3 months later. That's not good. You should get your way around this. Actually, they should have never inherited from the code activity. They should have created their own class that uses the code activity. That makes some more independence in your code. So this also happens. So what is it that you should actually do? Well, you should do things a bit differently. Actually, it starts with your software architecture. It does not start with selecting a framework. Selecting a framework is an activity that is somewhere further down the road, as I will try to explain to you. Because your software architecture is so much more than just a list of frameworks. I'll show you a random picture of our software architect. This is the architecture we use a lot in our projects. And it has a number of layers in there, as frameworks of software architectures usually are layered architectures. They don't have to be, but most business applications that we build actually have this. So there's a number of steps you should actually take before delving into selecting your frameworks. And I've put them up here. Actually, this is a new slide. I created it half an hour ago. So let's see what's on there. No, I know what's on there. The first thing you need to do is to check what are the actual requirements that I have for building my software architecture. And they might come from a particular project or from a line of project or from the software factory that you are setting up. And there's a lot of requirements that deal with, I don't know, logging or persistence or performance or testability or usability or whatever. And you have to gather those requirements. And from gathering those requirements, you set up a first architecture picture. You usually do that on a whiteboard with a marker so you can wipe it out and draw it again, etc., etc. And once you've done that, you've identified the layers that you need. Actually, in most architectures have a three-layer device. Like they have a presentation layer, a domain layer, and something that connects the domain to whatever's on the outside world. Whether that's an enterprise service bus, or whether that's SAP, or some Java backend, or BizTalk, or a database, for instance. Databases. I've seen those a while ago. They don't seem to be, nobody's creating new databases anymore. All the data's already there. We've got abundance of data in the world. So we just need to reuse the data. So you set up these layers, and the next thing is try to identify what the elements in those layers are, or the types in those layers are, that you will actually need to implement the responsibilities that you might have. So for instance, if I have a domain layer, I might end up with something with things that are domain objects, like a contact or an order or a customer or whatever you might have. Those are the basic elements in a domain layer. Or if you call them entities or domain objects, that doesn't really matter. Actually, the phrase entities comes from a book, very good book, which is called Domain-Driven Design by Eric Evans. I would certainly recommend it to you to read that all. That defines a lot of the terminology that is used in domain-driven design. Like, there's a factory. What does a factory do? Well, a factory creates instances of classes. Why do I need a factory to do that? Can I just do customer C equals new customer? Yes, you can do that. But with a customer, usually comes a bunch of addresses and a bunch of contact persons and whatever you might have in there. So you use a factory to create this whole, I don't know, this whole blob of things that come along with a customer. Otherwise, I could have said customer C equals new customer. So that's what a factory does. And then there's repositories. What a repository does is it gets you a number of instances, any or one instance or a number of instances from whatever your backend is. Like, I need all the customers that live in Amsterdam. And you will get back a list of customers or an innumerable of customers or whatever your implementation is. That's the responsibility of a repository. So you try to identify in each of these layers what are the basic elements that sit in these layers and that have, and what are the responsibilities of these elements. And once you find those responsibilities, you will need to check out, to implement these responsibilities, what collaborations do I need? If I have a repository, where does it get the data from? Does it get it itself from the database? Or should I delegate it to something that's maybe in a layer beneath, like a service gateway or a table gateway or whatever pattern you're implementing? There might be a gateway in the layer below that directs that to a database or a server or an SAP application or whatever. So you might delegate those responsibilities. So you have to find out, okay, to implement this, what do I actually need? And for instance, if I want to persist my domain objects, the repository is probably responsible for that. So the repository needs to have some features or some implementation to be able to save my domain objects. So where does that come from? And only that is the point where you start selecting your frameworks, because it depends on the responsibilities that these elements in your software architecture actually have. Like, okay, I want to save it. How can I do that? Well, I could do it using Entity Framework. I could do it using, I don't know, Link to SQL. I could use an Hibernate or Subsonic or whatever framework. So what fits the needs the best? That's the framework you need to select. And you can do that in all of these layers. Like, for instance, if I want to do something which is usually referred to as UI process handling, if you have an MVP implementation or an MVVM or an MVC or an MV whatever, any of those patterns will do. But you have to pick on one, the one that suits your needs the best. And then you say, okay, what is the framework that actually suits this? Can I use WSF Reserves for it, or does Silverlight have a very good implementation for it, or can I do my own implementation which might fit my need better? So you have to check that again and again and again until you find that, okay, this is my architecture, and all of these frameworks are actually on the side of your application delivering services to your software architecture. That's a good way of setting this up. So once you've done that, you can actually map those to your frameworks. And there's different frameworks for different purposes. So you can select the best of breed from that. And then there are some patterns, actually, I'm going to show you. And these patterns, actually, I will show you three that help you get rid of a bit of the dependencies on your framework. Because all the patterns I've just shown you, you do not want to have too much dependency on any of your frameworks. You want to indirect the dependency. So you can actually move from version 3 of WF to version 4 WF without having so much trouble, or from anhibernate to entity framework or back, or another UI pattern or whatever you might use, you'll be able to change that. So I'll show you three patterns. The first one is something called a layer supertype. It's actually, the phrase layer supertype was coined by Martin Fowler in his phenomenal book, Patterns of Enterprise Application Architecture. It's one of the best books in the industry. And the layer supertype, well, it's actually, it's an empty pattern. A layer supertype, I'll show you a layer supertype. That's better than showing all the text. You can download the presentation anyway, and you can download the longer version from my talk yesterday, so there's much more text in there. A layer supertype actually doesn't do anything, but it identifies something that you might say there's a lot of classes that will inherit from this thing. Like if I have a contact and an order and a person class and an order line and an address and stuff like that. Those are all, wow, I would call them domain objects. Then you might say, okay, you know what? I've identified this domain object in my architecture, so I'm gonna create this domain object class. And at first, it doesn't do anything. It's just an empty class. And you start inheriting your domain objects from that. And once you do that, you will recognize that, hey, there's functionality in my contact class that is very similar to the functionality in my customer class. And if you see that pattern, you can move it up to the domain object and get it out of these classes. So your domain object and your layer supertypes, any of your layer supertypes, will grow over time. And this is a perfect example. This is the controller class from ASP.NET MVC. And it's the base class from all controllers. So all controllers will inherit from that, like you will see in this example. Here's my home controller, and it directly inherits from controller. Personally, I wouldn't do this. Why? Well, because if you inherit directly from controller outside of using extension methods, there's no way you can manipulate this. And if there's a new version of controller coming out with the next version of ASP.NET MVC, they might have changed the implementation. So if you depend on it directly, you might get into trouble. You could put a very small layer of independence in between these two. You could say, well, you know what? I'm going to create my own base controller, or whatever you call it. Has anybody done this? What's a good name for that? What? I used the word base controller yesterday, but you could also name it after your own framework. Like if your framework is called, I don't know what, Hawaii, you could call it the Hawaii controller or whatever. But you could do it something a little bit in between. And that gives you the opportunity to add functionality to your own controller, which now is your layer supertype, has become your layer supertype, and uses the controller functionality. And there's two ways of doing that. You can inherit from it, which means that you will expose all the features of controller to your base, to your actual implementation classes. And you could also wrap it. Like I have my own controller, my base controller, and inside sits an instance of the controller class. You can do that. In this case, I wouldn't do that, but there's other situations that you might want to do that if you do not want to expose everything that's in that base class from a particular framework. So there's a layer of indirection you can make here. And a layer supertype, you know, any of these elements in your software architecture are viable to create a layer supertype for. All of them. Actually, I would do it instantly. I would create a service gateway class. I don't know what it does. It probably connects to some service, so I will end up with features to connect to a service. That's good. And a domain object, and a repository-based class, and we have a use case-based class also in our frameworks, but I will talk about that on Friday. And something about pages, too. There's a web page. You can use the page, but you can also inherit from page and use your own functionality to add that. For instance, to do a bit of authorization or whatever you might do, or multilinguality, or whatever's necessary for your application. So you can do that for all of these classes. Like in this code example, it's a code example from the domain object base class. It didn't have anything, and it ended up with having a title property, which is easy to use on pages and on forms. It has an ID property, and it has a connection to its factory and its repository or whatever, and it has some internal state. So you end up adding more features to your layer supertype. And the good thing about it is that you can now build this layer of independence, a little framework of your own, using these types. Like, I want to save the compositions for my domain object, like all associations with other domain objects. If there are any properties of those in my domain object, I want to be able to save them all automatically. It's like a cascaded save or something. You could also do a cascaded delete, of course, but it's in the same function. So you can define functionality based on your own base classes. And that's good. That will give you a more stable environment. It also will save your less experienced developers from having to delve into everything that sits underneath with Entity Framework or whatever shit you're using. And of course, you can also do a lot of extension. I love extension methods, don't you? They're great. Actually, our own frameworks, I think they doubled in lines of code when we started using, we're creating fluent interfaces for everything now. And that's great. You don't have to do that, by the way, but it looks really hip. And if hip is still a viable word these days, I think my children would call it fat or something, whatever. So you can do all of these things with the layer supertype. Next, I will show you a very small pattern. And this very small pattern comes from a problem that it's in the text, but I will skip the text. I will show you the code. I love showing code. You know, I have something in my framework which is called the task manager. It runs use cases. That's what it does. The first parameter in the method to run a use case is the name of the use case. You would expect it to be an enumeration. And it is a sort of an enumeration, but it is not an enumeration. But why? Because with enumerations, trouble begins. Because in the simple case, I want to be able to call it like this. This is the name of my application, and it has a sort of an enumeration that has all the use case in it. So I want to be able to do this. But if I would do this using an enum, the enum has to be in the framework as well, because this class is in the framework, the task manager. So the application task also needs to be in my framework. And if I use an enum, this trouble will begin. Like, I can define the method. I can say, okay, I have an enum called levels, and I can put in a parameter like this, and I can actually call it like this, levels.high. But if I want, if this is all my framework code, and this is my application code, this is not possible with an enum. You cannot inherit from an enum because it's not a class, it's a struct. So this won't help. So what a lot of people do then, they actually start using string collections, which of course looks nice, but it has a different implementation. Like, where's my string collection? Ah, there's my string collection. This is a good, okay, I'll move. Okay, people start doing this. Like, I'm going to do this static string called high and medium and low. It sounds good because you can still do this, validate level, levels.high. But the definition of my method is different now. It doesn't have the levels type anymore. It has string type, which means I can put in any string I like, which is not something you want to do because you want to have this type safe. So there's a solution to that, and it's an easy solution. I'll show you the code. Just skip the text slides. Read them afterwards, please. So what we've done is we created a class, and we call it the descriptor class. And it doesn't do very much. It actually sort of mimics an enumeration. So it has more or less the same functionality an enum would have. But it's implemented as a class. And we inherit that. And the first part of code that you see here is the actual application task class that I've had on the slide before. So it's a sort of, it creates instances, but instead of using strings, it's using instances of the same class, which means it's type safe, because the parameter is still called application task, and I can put in any application task that I have. And this is in my framework. And since this is in my framework and it is a class, I can inherit from it. So what I did is I created a class called 84 task, which my application is called 84. It inherits from application task, and it extends the class with, it also has a subject, but that doesn't really matter now, with a lot of these instances that actually are types of this one. Which means anywhere I run my use case, I want to run my use case. I think I've got this code put up, although I don't have much time left. It's difficult to do this in 3/4 of an hour, you know. Like here. See, I can actually do this, and it actually acts like it's an enumeration. Well, there it is. See, there's a whole bunch of these tasks in there. And these are actually the tasks that I've identified as the instances of the class I want. Which one do I have? Select company? Otherwise, my code won't run for Friday. So you can use this as being an enum, but it gets you away from the default enums that are used. Actually, we stop using enums altogether in our frameworks. For instance, the trouble you might get into is if you have log levels defined, for instance. Like I have a log manager and I want a log, they probably have a log level. But these are fixed, because if you use a framework, they will have 5 levels defined or 4 or whatever. And I want to define 2 extra. You cannot do that. So that's a basic need for this descriptor pattern. It's a great little pattern. It's easy to implement because there's not much more to it than this. And it will save you a lot of these enum-like problems that you might have in creating this small layer of independence. So there's some more code in there. Okay, on to the last pattern. It's the same code again. There's one small example that I want to show you where it is of great use. This is code from ASP.NET MVC, and everything is done by convention in ASP.NET MVC. So this is a class that sits somewhere in a directory, and this is a method on the class. If you have a lot of these methods and a lot of these classes, and you change the name of one of them, all this code breaks. That's the risk you run by using ASP.NET MVC. It's by convention. Convention is good, but you can enforce it. So what I did, I created an extension method that is called link, works on the HTML helper class, and I've created two of these descriptor classes. People can use them, people can extend them in their own project. So we created this very small layer of independence between ASP.NET MVC and the actual code. So they're now using these classes to identify the methods and the classes. So if the name changes, you only need to change that in one location. So that's a good use of this. So the last pattern. It's a bit about dependency injection. I will skip talking about dependency injection. I will explain it very briefly. It's a way of segregating implementation from the interface. So what it basically does is, it's creating instances of, for instance, interfaces, but they don't have to be interfaces, at runtime, which means at runtime I can plug in different functionality from what I might expect. So there's the interface. I'll show you the code. This one's good if you have enough time. There's different types of dependency injection. Most people use constructor injection. Constructor injection says, I'm going to create this object, I'm going to look at the constructor and see what types are in the constructor, and I'm going to create those as well. So you can have a whole tree of classes generating from just one call. So you need to have a dependency injection engine, and there's quite a few good ones, like the Unity block is a very good one, or structure map, or in the Spring framework, this one. So this is how it works. The next thing is, we use a lot of manual injection, as we call it. That is, we do not get the constructor out. We could have done that, but we created something like, we're using something called Object Factory, which is a small layer around our DI engine. And if I have this this variable, I'm going to fill it the first time I'm going to use it. So it looks at something called iValidation policy, and you have to have that in a configuration file or in code somewhere, which ones will be plugged in. And that's the good thing about dependency injection. It allows you, in different settings, to implement or to plug in different things. Like in my regular application, as a validation handler, I would plug in something called a web validation handler, which does something on your forms and your screens and your fields, etc., etc. It's all on screen. But if I run tests, unit tests, then I do it differently because I'm plugging in the test validation handler, and that has totally different functionality. The code stays the same, but the functionality that actually gets executed is totally different. So in different environments, you can run the same code with different effects. That's the effect of using dependency injection. And what we've done with it, actually, when using dependency injection, you still get to instantiate a lot of stuff in your application and in your framework. And we said, well, we're going to use a slightly different pattern for that. We're going to use something that we've called manager provider. So here's the thing you can do. You can create something, in this case, it's a validation manager. And the validation manager, well, he actually has only one method. Now, there's a few more, but one I will explain. And there's an interface. This is the interface that will get created using the dependency injection engine. And actually, it has a list of those interfaces. So there's more policies I can plug in my actual application. So here's all the implementations. And in code, it looks like this. So here's my interface. It has a validate method. And there's an object that I want to validate, whatever object that is. I don't actually care what object it is. And here's the creation of those instances. It says, okay, if there's policies, well, we need to build them all. And here we plug them in. So at runtime, the first time I'm going to validate, it will actually create these instances or this enumerable of these instances, and I will actually be able to do the validation. How? Well, here's how we plug them in, and here's the actual code. So here's the validate method. And here's the implementation for it in the validation manager. And it says, well, for each iValidation policy, we're going to call the validate method. So at runtime, three or four of those get plugged in, one to do business rule validation, one to do attribute validation, one to do child object validation or association validation. So you can build a lot of those. But you can build them independently of the use of this framework. So here's how it validates. And if you look at the actual application code, this is good. Why is this good? Well, because this creates very, very simple code. any developer, even VB developers, or Java developers, or COBOL developers might be able to write this code. Is there anything worse? Yeah, ABAP developers. It's the SAP language. That's okay. Let's don't discuss that. So here's the validation manager that validate. I'm going to validate a role object. That's all there is to it. And what happens underneath, it doesn't show. So if you have a bunch of less experienced developers in your project, and that's very likely that you have those, you're just going to tell them, okay, just validate. That's it. You don't need to know more. And it gets validated, and it has some results, and if it succeeds, you do something else. So there's the whole basic idea is that it simplifies your application development, and it creates a small layer of independence between all the stuff you need to do with dependency injection, which is not that trivial, especially when you have less experienced developers, and you encapsulate that in a very simple mechanism. And that will give you another form of flexibility. So when you use it in a whole bunch of stuff. All the stuff that sits on the side of your application, like we use it for resource management, not just a Microsoft, ASP.NET resource manager, which is a very basic thing, but we have our resources in a database, for instance, or in an XML file, or somewhere else, or somewhere on the web, or whatever they are. So we're going to use an additional layer to put our own resource manager in. We do that for logging, for state management, for validation, and also for testing, but we'll explain that on Friday, because it works great on unit testing as well, this pattern. So that's about it. So what should you do? Not start saying with, okay, I'm going to need a bunch of frameworks. Frameworks, there's a reason for having these frameworks. And it comes from your software architecture. So first set up your requirements for your software architecture. Set up your software architecture. Find out what elements are in there, what the responsibilities of those are, and what other functionality do I need to implement those responsibilities. And it's only then that your frameworks come along. And then put in all the frameworks you need. Pull them all in and make sure you have this little umbrella of independence, and these three patterns I've shown you and a lot of more of the stuff in there will help you be a little bit more independent of your frameworks. So that's about it. If you want to see this talk again, it's a rerun on tomorrow in an hourly session, so I'll leave you to it. Thank you for being here. These are my references. If you want to have additional questions, you might email me or you might tweet me, and that's also the case. Please do not forget to fill in your evaluation forms. Thank you all for being here until the end of the session, and I hope to see you tomorrow on Friday.